Game Podcast from Cold Omaha. I'm Tom Schreier. He's Max Hamilton. We have a great show for you today. In today's show, we'll start with Kickstarter and some of the recent headlines pertaining to how developers fund new projects. Later in the podcast, we'll discuss whether or not you need an online connection in order to play next-gen games at this point. But obviously, starting with Kickstarter, let's discuss what is Kickstarter, for starters.
So for anyone not familiar with it, Kickstarter is an online website. It's a platform for anyone to promote anything they want, any sort of product, and they can basically sell it by making their case to the public, and anyone that wants to can donate. And generally, there's a set time frame, a set amount, and sometimes different backing tiers. And when you back at certain levels, you might get a prize, like a T-shirt or a signed autograph, or spend a day with whoever's making what. And this has been a really big platform in the video game industry as far as indie titles, and now some AAA names are leaving to go to Kickstarter and make some of these titles.
Yeah, so I mean, it seems like a big thing is how to make money, knowing that, you know, first of all, there's inflation, right? And they say $60 is kind of like $51 back kind of two generations ago when they increased that. Some companies are going with DLC, some's like Assassin's Creed, as we discussed earlier, and I think a couple podcasts ago. They're doing it in ways that some people feel like is unfair. You're not getting good price. I would say it seems like a natural place for someone to go, especially if you have a new project. And I think once those people kind of migrated there, AAA people who, again, are struggling to make some money in some cases, find that, hey, you know, if you like our project, how about you fund it? You know, give us some money to start out with. And it's obviously not just for video games. I think, you know, there's...
Right, no, there's books, there's, you know, fan fiction movies that people are putting together, discussions like political shows, and I mean, there was even a potato salad joke on there that raised quite a bit of money, and the rest went to charity. So
yeah, and even like Feminist Frequency was Kickstarter, wasn't it, or something like that? It was privately funded.
Is that the Sarkeesian?
Yeah.
Yeah, yep, nope, that got its start there, and I believe that there's another line of work that she's doing. I don't know if it's through Kickstarter, though, again.
Yeah, so again, going back to that point, it's a way to fund new games. For you, do you believe that this is helping kind of break up the monotony of AAA titles that kind of come out every year? You kind of know what to expect, kind of a, your Call of Duty's, Assassin's Creed's, or do you think that this is essentially being taken over by AAA titles and it's not really making much of a difference?
I think that there's just no way for it to really get taken over by AAA titles, because this is basically, you know, people know exactly what they're going to get theoretically, and can pay for what they want, in advance. It's all spelled out. And the beauty of it is that unless a game or any project on Kickstarter meets its funding, your money isn't, your pledge isn't taken unless it happens. So, like, for example, I don't know if you're familiar with the Oatmeal. This was the latest thing I backed, but he is an online cartoonist and makes pretty funny comics and books and things like that. And they got a game coming out, a card game, a tabletop, called Exploding Kittens. And it's actually co-developed with some people from the video game industry. Drawing a blank on their names off the top of my head, but basically it's $35 to get a deck of the cards, and of course the Not Safe for Work edition. I sprung for that, and it is not going to be charged unless they met their goal. Well, it turns out that this is one of the biggest Kickstarters in history as far as success goes. It's just hit 150,000 backers, I think was the number.
Wow.
And it's got like 5 million. And, they were looking for, I think, 10 starting out. Once the time limit's been reached, they take your money and then they start work on the product, and you get shipped whatever your level of backing was, whatever the reward tier was. And so it's a good system to kind of just figure out what exactly you want and just put your money where you want it to go.
So what is the risk, I guess? What is the risk someone who's funding this is taking?
So the risk is that, you know, these developers promise all these things, or that they end up making unrealistic goals and then they can't meet those goals. One of the popular things that turned out to be a really big success when Kickstarter first started was having stretch goals. So, you know, I might have started by asking for $50,000. I might have met that, and then I say, well, hey, how about this? If we hit $75,000, I'll add this level to the game, or this many new characters, or there will be more DLC. And the best example of this is Star Citizen. Star Citizen was another thing I backed, and it has had so much success that I want to say 500 million, but maybe that's more than it actually is. But they kept coming up with stretch goal after stretch goal, and the concern there is that, you know, it started out as this indie studio and now it's huge, and Chris Roberts, you're wondering if he has enough people or enough resources despite all the money to actually fulfill on all these crazy promises and worlds and things like that.
Well, yeah, and I guess the question too is for these people who literally are kickstarting a project, do they understand the business side of it? Do they understand, you know, a AAA studio probably knows how many programmers they need, how many artists they need, how to get the music, and then how to obviously cater to people who are publishing their product. Is that, as someone who's backed multiple projects, in addition to the risk, is that a concern for you?
It is, especially with the things that you really, really want to see happen. The best example of this is Star Citizen, because so many people just want this to be the best space game ever, and they're promising a lot. And it's also kind of marked the revival of the space sim genre, because now you have No Man's Sky coming out, and Elite Dangerous just came out, and there's a bunch of indie small games on Steam, and a few others, and we'll see what the Star Wars universe brings us. But yeah, you know, as AAA developers see the competition on Kickstarter, they start kind of following that pattern of money and cater to what the audience wants, and that takes business away from them, or maybe puts more pressure on the Kickstarter developers. And yeah, sometimes projects fall through, and there's nothing that they're able to do about the lack of funding, or they have to look elsewhere, and it never comes to fruition. The biggest disappointment, though, is when we have broken promises, where they do meet their funding, and what happens to those people that backed at certain levels expecting certain things, it just falls through and nothing happens.
So what, in that case, you lose your money and you're not getting the game you wanted.
Right. Your money's taken. There's no refunds. There's nothing to do about that. And all you can really do is kind of join in an online outcry against, hey, you know, you promised this. What are you going to do to fix it? Now, you generally will get your game. It's just not, you know, they might have been like, well, we should have asked for this much money to do this stretch goal, or we shouldn't have had stretch goals in general. The most recent example of this, and it was in the news just the other day, actually, but Ouya, are you familiar with that? It was a kind of an indie gaming system for $100 that came out, and it was kind of
What
like,
is it called?
it's called Ouya, Ouya, and
Hmm.
or I may be pronouncing it wrong. But basically, it's kind of like a Roku box almost. You just plug it
Yeah.
into your TV. It's really casual, easy gaming. Things like Angry Birds and just tiny games like that. And they partnered with Reading Rainbow because there was a Kickstarter to bring Reading Rainbow back. And the
Interesting.
deal was that if you backed at, I think, the $250 level, there were going to be 500 blue, sky blue, like Reading Rainbow, special edition Ouyas to give out to these backers, and they're all going to be signed by LeVar Burton, the host of Reading Rainbow. So just the other day, they announced that, you know, we didn't have all the counts in time, and there were some basically production issues, and they weren't going to be able to make these blue ones. So they're still going to get signed editions, and to make amends, they decided to include an extra controller, which, you know, it's an off-brand system that only costs $100, so it's not a huge value. But at least, you know, in this example, they're taking steps to please the people that backed it, even though they can't fulfill on their promise.
Just want to ask real quick for people that don't know, Star Citizen is what? Aside from a space game.
Yeah, well, so basically, it's kind of like Eve Online, except not a real-time strategy. And for anyone who doesn't know what Eve Online is, I guess that's not a good definition. But basically, it's a wide-open space sim where you start at the ground level with a spaceship. It's first person, and you can do whatever you want. You can trade, you can be a bounty hunter, you can be a pirate, you can just anything you can think of. And basically, your job is to take on missions and raise money, and you know, you can play with friends and explore the universe, and there's combat aspects, and you know, it's basically another life you can live in space from your PC.
What is how does it compare to No Man's Sky? I mean, is there even a
So
comparison there?
I don't think they're, I mean, obviously, I've only played limited releases of the backer content for Star Citizen, and read up on it, obviously. But from what I have heard of No Man's Sky, it's gonna be, No Man's Sky is more of a casual gaming experience from what I can pick up. You know, there's limited
Yeah.
knowledge. But Star Citizen is a very in-depth simulation. It's I'd say it's like playing SimCity, whereas Star Citizen might be more of a Clash of Clans thing. It's just
Interesting.
more casual.
What is the appeal? I guess what is the appeal then of a Kickstarter game like that as opposed to a AAA title that's being hyped like No Man's Sky?
Yeah, well, both are being extremely hyped. I'd say the appeal with Star Citizen is just, the cool thing is you hear about all these stretch goals and you're like, oh, I'm going to back this and hope more people back it because it would be really cool if they spent the time and energy and money to get this content that they're promising. And it's cool because you can see what you're getting or theoretically getting. And, with this other stuff, like, yeah, there's reviews and things like that, but you have no control. You're not like actually contributing to the development. Kickstarter is just it's a way to get involved at the ground level, and there's often open communication with the developers. And it's really appealing to developers and people creating other content outside of the video game realm because they have complete control of their product. They're able to bring you their vision, whereas, with a AAA title, you're at the mercy of the publishers or, corporate politics and things like that.
Do you believe it spurs innovation?
I think that the innovation is spurred from the developers and the artists in any industry. It's regardless of if it's on Kickstarter or not, but I think Kickstarter just grants them that total freedom, with some constraints, obviously. It depends on how successful the campaign was and the time limits they put on themselves. But yeah, I think there's just more freedom on Kickstarter. But yeah, go ahead.
In general, from a consumer standpoint, do you feel like this is a better way to fund games than, I mean, I understand with AAA you're not funding it, but is this better for the
It's
consumer, do you feel?
difficult to say because, when a product and a launch go successful, it's great because you get exactly what you wanted. You might have gotten in early enough to pay less for the product than full price, but the problem is that if it falls through, you didn't waste any money because it didn't get fully backed, but you're also you could have been investing in something else or pursuing some other line that you were interested in. And this happened. The other thing, the headline that Kickstarter was grabbing recently was a game called Goddess. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
So it is a top-down, very casual gaming experience where you play a god, and it's all touch-based. There is a PC version too. And basically, you have a Stone Age village that you kind of cultivate, and you can expand them across the land, and it's. You shape the land by dragging your finger across the screen or your mouse, and you can, create water or land masses, mountains, sand, forests, whatever you got to do. And basically, you get these people to follow you and go take over other villages and things like that. Well, this was a Kickstarter game, and there was supposed to be this really big online component. Well, this game was developed by Peter Molyneux, who is the mastermind behind Fable, and
Yeah.
he's kind of gotten a record now for making promises. Big promises and not delivering on them. Fable, I loved the first one. The second one was kind of lackluster, and the third one just kind of felt empty, I guess, or didn't really deliver on all these promises that the second one was supposed to, and the third one was meant to fix that. Anyways, he had this little puzzler iPhone game where if you got to the middle of it, the first one to get to the middle of it would get some grand prize, and this was almost 2 years ago now. And the first one to get to the middle was an 18-year-old kid. I think overseas in England, but he was told that he would be the first ultimate god in the game, and he would oversee all the other players, and he would create the rules, and he would get a cut of the revenue and all this and that. Well, now there was just an interview, I believe Game Informer did it, and Polygon was reporting something on it too. But the kid, since 2 years ago, has not seen any money from it. The company really has kind of like stopped contacting and responding to him. And when Molyneux was contacted about this, he just kind of like shrugged his shoulders almost and was like, oh, yeah, it's unfortunate. It's bad on us for just doing that. But it turns out like they never got the multiplayer component to really work. So people just instead ended up with this game with a lot of microtransactions and nothing to it,
How important then is the transparency, maybe that these people are on social media, that they're doing interviews with Polygon, Game Informer, so on and so forth,
Right.
because it seems like you're putting a lot of trust into these people who you're backing, obviously.
Yeah, and it's been successfully kickstarted, so these people lost their money, and now, you know, there's no follow through in the development phase, where, you know, the PC game and the iPhone game, with the iPhone one at least it's free, but there's a lot of paywalls and time walls in it. You know, there's a cool concept there, it's just they don't follow through, and they're being transparent now that they're, you know, under the microscope, but you know, where was all this communication before, and happened
during the development of the game, excuse me, while they're raising money? It seems like it's imperative for someone who's breaking into this, who's trying to receive Kickstarter money,
right,
to be on social media, to go and do interviews and be accessible to these people who either are going to consume the game or back it, right?
Right, absolutely. And a lot of the Kickstarters, the really successful ones, are very transparent and communicate with their people. Like Star Citizen, almost every week, if not more frequent, they have video updates and a little developer commentary and newsletters, and I get emails all the time about where it's at and what's new and what to expect. The thing with this Goddess game, and it's not a AAA title, but even now it just feels like an experiment that, you know, didn't go anywhere, and they're just letting it die. So we'll see what comes of it. But again, he's the developer, Peter Molyneux, who's got kind of a bad rap now, and the gaming community has for a while with some failed attempts.
What games are you looking out for? I mean, what are some projects maybe to get behind, or games even just to consume if you're you know, not planning on backing a game but want to play something unique or new?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of games on Kickstarter. Definitely take a look at what else is out there. But game-wise, another one I backed and really enjoyed is Shadowrun. I don't know if you remember.
I'm familiar with that one, yeah.
There was a multiplayer title, which was pretty fun, on, I think, the 360. And basically, Shadowrun is this kind of futuristic world where there's a mix of sci-fi and fantasy, where you have, like, a magical underground kind of repressed society, and then you have the corporations that are militaristic and try to control everything, and they're just always at war. Well, this game went back to the original, successfully kickstarted, and it's a top-down kind of RPG turn-based type game. And, you know, minimalistic graphics and everything, but a very cool story, and really it pulls you in. It's just fun and quirky, and it's a cool world to explore. And that was so successful that they actually have another one on there called, I think it is just Shadowrun Hong Kong, and it's an expansion or a sequel. But yeah, there's plenty on there. So another one that I mentioned in an earlier podcast that I just bought into early access on Steam is Stranded Deep. And that's that survival game. It's like a castaway simulation. So basically, yeah, your plane crashes, you're on an island trying to survive. And it's cool when there's early access, because you can see the game as it develops. You know, you get this bare bones product that might not be very fun, but you get to kind of play around with the concepts and see where it goes and what it grows into.
Anything else we need to know about, you know, Kickstarter games? Anything to look forward to here?
I think just the one thing to keep in mind is that with Kickstarter, you need to understand that it is not guaranteed until your money is taken. And even then, if you didn't invest in a trustworthy source, if you didn't back someone that actually knows what they're doing, or at least has laid out a plan to deliver these promises, one, you only have yourself to blame, and two, you know, it's an investment, and investments aren't a sure thing. So you just got to do your research and look for the best ones to give your money to, and hope things work out.
What are some steps to take before we kind of end this segment? What are some steps to take to minimize risk, I guess, to ensure that you're giving money to good people?
Yeah, well, definitely follow the money. There's a way to look for kind of the most popular products and projects on there and see who's backing what. And, you know, just pure numbers isn't enough to guarantee success. So look at their history. What else have they worked on? What have they produced? Have they done other successful Kickstarters? Because success breeds success, especially on that site. And once they kind of know how to run a successful project, they just do it again and again, or work with other people and consult on how to do theirs. So really, you know, look at their pedigree, look at other people backing it, and kind of just follow along. Maybe don't back it until that last day, until that final deadline. And kind of see if people are, you know, if it's gaining popularity, if people are dropping out of it, if there's red flags, if the developers have internal problems, things like that.
When we come back, we'll discuss whether or not, I know that with these next-gen systems that you don't have to be online, but you kind of have to be because of the new patches and DLC. big discussions when the next gen systems were kind of being introduced to the public was whether or not Xbox would be online all the time, that you'd have to have an online, you know, connection, that you would download the games, and then ultimately if you were offline you couldn't play the system. You know, obviously that's kind of dead and buried at this point. Obviously,
right.
You can play.
Sony let Microsoft fall on their sword with that one, and you know, they were the first console out of the gate. Microsoft had all these plans for digital only and family sharing, and the console would always have to be online or at least connect once every 24 hours. And, you know, it raises all these problems for what about people in rural areas? What about people with lousy internet connections, people that don't always want to be online for maybe privacy reasons, hacking, things like that? You know, for whatever a consumer's reasons, they have their right to have that respect.
Yeah. I mean, part of this conversation was how Kinect works, and people are concerned that, you know, someone may be seeing you through the other side, and ironically, Kinect has kind of gone the
ways. Right. And I mean, there was even some question or reports of Microsoft cooperating with, I think was it the NSA, providing some data, and there's some funny political commentary. Just, yeah, the terrorists are sitting around Kinect somewhere playing
watching
Xbox.
Some guy play Xbox, which
but,
would be ultimately very boring.
Right.
But,
and then now, I mean, just in the news the other day, you have the smart TVs like Samsung, and they listen in on you and report back to the basically the developers of these TVs to kind of get your one, personal information, and two, kind of your consumer info and how to target you with sales and things like that.
Yeah, and obviously a concern to me who has an Xbox and has a smart TV from Samsung. But
right.
I think one of those things why I was for this at the time and maybe in the minority about this is, hey, yeah, I'm in a place that has good online connection. And obviously, and people, if you have a setup, a lot of people do kind of bundle online and TV. But the other thing, too, is I do like that you don't have to buy physical discs. I've obviously scratched discs before. You can have them stolen.
Right.
And I think I like the idea that you can pre-download a game and then have it ready to go once it, you know, comes out on that first day. The negative about that, a lot of people are saying, hey, that feature is nice, but I don't use it, is because there's so many patches that come out. Unity was one of those. But even,
right.
You know, we talk about Diablo and we talk about, I mean, just about any game under the sun, even Grand Theft Auto, which was well done, has a lot of updates. It just feels like it'd be more difficult. Obviously, you can't play online without the, you know,
right.
Multiplayer without online. But, I, you know, even for one-player games, you know, most of those games, you have to go through a Dragon Age. You have to go through a screen where you sign in with an account through EA.
Right, and half the time it doesn't even connect to the server.
Yeah, and so I think for me, I felt like that was kind of taking the next step. Like when you create a new next-gen system, you're actually kind of creating new technology and how things will be consumed in the future. And I'm someone who gets magazines kind of online. I mean, basically anything that I can go digital with, I do.
Right.
But there are concerns, obviously, with, you know, around the holiday season, you know, PlayStation and Xbox, their networks got hacked, and people weren't able to kind of register and sign up and get their gamer tag going and stuff like that. And then just also kind of with the TurboTax, obviously people have had trouble with their taxes that are done online. You know, we're still figuring this out, even though we're years into having online connections and it's become very standard. But every time a game is released where it's not done perfectly and there's a big patch that comes out with it, there's always someone in kind of a rural area or someone who has a lower speed internet, or, you know, maybe even is just in a time period where they don't have internet. Maybe they're moving to a new place or something like that, that will complain, and rightfully so, saying, hey, I can't play my Xbox One, or I can't play my PS4. Part of me thinks is, hey, the next step is kind of online, and we're going to figure out ways to kind of expand internet throughout
America. I mean, access grows and it becomes more affordable to an extent. And the other thing to consider is data caps and limits. You know, one of the Assassin's Creed patches ended up being almost the whole game, I think, 40 gig download for the Xbox to fix everything, and it wasn't supposed to be. I think it was initially a 7 gig download, but even then, you know, if you have a limited amount of gigs, whether it's 100 or 50 a month or who knows, that eats up the entire thing or a good chunk of it, and, you know, then you end up paying quite a bit for anything excess.
Yeah, so, I mean, from my personal angle, and find that games are kind of online, and I feel like this is just kind of, it's gradually going this way. It's still, as someone who writes, you know, works in journalism and works with the papers, I realize that, yeah, you know, I think some people do consume, you know, ink and paper and want physical
right.
magazines.
Yeah.
And obviously with books, I think longer form stuff, you know, those things aren't going to go away. But the way we produce content, I mean, most of my stuff is online. You can listen to The Ticket online, stuff like that. And so I guess I'm not fighting it, but I might be a little more forward-thinking and be more willing to kind of take a risk and see how it goes.
Right. And you were one of the – I mean, even when we first got our systems and everything came out, you were one of the early adopters of the digital stuff where just right off the bat everything was digital. I was – a little slow on that. Like, I was fine with, you know, Microsoft coming out and saying everything is going to be digital, and the family sharing plan was awesome, the 10 people on a game and all that. For whatever reason, I just liked having a physical library collection, just something to look at, and, you know, some of the cases and designs are cool, and more of, like, just kind of a display thing. But started getting a couple digital games, and it is nice being able to be lazy and just have it all right there on your dashboard and select through it. And so now I'm almost exclusively digital. The only issue I have with that is, you know, if there's an update or the download's taking too long or there's some connectivity issues, it can be pretty frustrating. But then on the other side, like you said, there's scratch discs, and I've already had trouble with my Xbox One's reader not working properly, and you know, things not getting scanned or getting scratched inside the system, and it's, you know, it's pros and cons on both sides.
Yeah, could you see maybe with, in terms of having a physical library, I think people like that. It's like with books. It's like with magazines. People like magazines that you can kind of display on a table. Could you see it where they maybe ship something in a box that's like a chip that it would allow you to download it faster or something like that, but ultimately it's still a digital copy. It's still, you don't need to remove and insert a disc every time you play
a game. I think at the end of the day, once everything's said and done, and all the companies know this, is that it's moving digital. I think where they make their money in physical products is the pre-order bonuses where, you know, you might get a statue or some toys or for the big spenders, you know, for instance, that Borderlands $400 edition where you get a claptrap, you know?
Yeah. Which is awesome.
Oh, yeah. No, I would have dropped money on that if I was
just $400
more of a free spender. Yeah. But I think that's kind of a very select crowd, because the average person, you know, some kids in high school or college students are not running out to get special editions for $120 or more and get a big collection of gaming memorabilia that, you know, it's just a core.
Yeah, and what some people are doing now is understanding that, you know, if you create, you know, from the consumer standpoint, if you want a game right away, you pay the $60. Otherwise, you kind of wait until you get a deal at the $45-$30 rate. And then I think there's kind of an understanding, even if you get a game later, I think of like when I bought Fallout 3 well after it had come out, I also understand that I'm going to probably have to pay $5 here and there in order to pick up the DLC. So I think while people are less willing to, for example, go pick up a Claptrap for $400.
Right.
They are more willing to, if it's your favorite game or one of your favorite series, to go buy a $60 game and then understand that you may end up spending $80 or $90 total on that game just because you're picking up DLC.
And we kind of touched on that in the discussion of the state of gaming before in our earlier podcast, where to get a complete game these days, the whole experience, it never happens right out of the box. There's no way to do it because, you know, there's going to be a season pass, and now there's even content beyond the season passes or two seasons, you know, and there's little exclusive DLCs for different systems or, you know, editions of the game that might be an extra character or costumes or a challenge map pack or what have you. And all this stuff is usually timed exclusive. So you need to wait quite some time before you can get it, and then at that point, like, oh, are you even playing that game? Do I want to go back to it? You know, it's kind of just a lose-lose situation for the consumer that wants to pay one price for everything. And, you know, if they had to up the games by $10, do you think you
would
do
that? That's
what
I was going to ask. Would you rather pay $70 or $80 for a game that you know you're going to get a whole bunch of content, or are you kind of excited by DLC, that, you know, additional content that comes out over time?
So with games like Oblivion, and that kind of started it all with the famous horse, or I should say infamous horse armor DLC. It was mainly a cosmetic item. That DLC overall was really exciting for me because, you know, it was these big expansions and totally new stories. You had Knights of the Nine and the Shivering Isles expansion. And, you know, for those who didn't play it, it is entire new worlds and maps and quests for a game that was already quite large. Same with Red Dead Redemption, the Western game made by Rockstar. When they came out with the Undead Nightmare pack, it was a whole new version of that game for a fraction of the price. So if they do DLC like that, I have absolutely no problem. Now, if they're gonna do DLC, I don't want to pay more than $60 for the base product or game, depending on the size of the game. But to pay $70, maybe even 80, if you're guaranteeing that that is gonna be everything, I wouldn't be against that. And I think someday it is gonna be 70, not too far
And
off.
you prefer that as opposed to $60 plus a $20 season pass?
Well, here's the thing with the season pass. Usually now they've gone up since the last gen because they know they need to increase prices to make it worthwhile. So you're looking at $30 or $40 for a season pass. With Battlefield and Call of Duty, it's $50. And I have bought, I'll probably do it with Advanced Warfare. But I did do the Battlefield 4 season pass, and that was 60 for the base game, 50 for premium. So you're looking at $110 there. And then on top of that, there's all these, and I haven't bought any of this, but for people that don't have a lot of time to invest in the game, because every weapon class, there's a whole chain to unlock, and then there's 150 levels of rank and format packs and a bunch of stuff. Basically, there are shortcuts where you can buy them to get to the end of it instantly and not have to do the grinding. And those are anywhere from $5 to $15 a pop, depending on what you're looking at. And so, if someone wanted to buy absolutely everything available in that game, they're looking at a couple hundred dollars.
What do you prefer with certain games, like different models prevail? Like we talked about Mortal Kombat, it makes sense to me that you get a $60 game that's well polished, that has the key characters, that has new fatalities, good stadiums, and stuff like that. Do you get that $60 game and then you kind of increase the amount of characters by, you pay $5 for this one, $5 for this one, maybe $5 for a new stage? Or even like I think of a sports game, maybe you get the package right away, maybe even at like $40, and then each year maybe you pay a little bit to update the rosters or something like that.
Right,
I
or
mean, do you,
maps or.
yeah, and then with the shooting games, obviously it seems like you'd have like $60 up front and then maybe certain map packs and stuff like that, gun packs. I mean,
Right.
do you think that they're eventually going to be, now it's just a standard $60. Do you think that they're going to kind of throw that out the window and say, hey, certain games cost a certain amount up front and then you have DLC? I mean, how do you think that's going to be done?
I think right now it's too hard to say, and it's going to be how it is right now for a long time to come, until they can sway the masses into finding a perfect balance between what they're charging and the content they're offering. But there's definitely experimentation going on. I mean, MMOs and PC games have been doing paid subscriptions for a long time. You pay, like with Elder Scrolls Online that just got released fairly recently, and I believe the console version is coming out in April. But it was a $60 base game with a $15 a month paid subscription. And with that, you had complete 100% access to everything. But I mean, every 4 months, you're basically dropping $60 on a game you already paid $60 for. So with the console version, they have, and this was predicted, that they dropped the subscription. So now you're going to be paying for DLC instead. The problem with DLC, though, in these situations is you're cutting off your entire player base for anyone that doesn't join in
Kind of
with
like
the D.
Destiny.
Right, exactly. And so they have to find ways to balance it, like Borderlands, where they allow people with the DLC to play with people that don't have it, but only as long as
One that
they're,
they're.
one person.
I mean, the way I see it, I think the business model is going to change because the problem here is people are saying, hey, I paid $60 for a game, it has to come as a complete product. And more to me, and this kind of goes back to this Kickstarter situation, is that, you talked about kind of the reach goals, right? If I get a certain amount
Right.
of money, I'll give you more. I wonder if even AAA titles would be more like that. We talk about Titanfall, and people felt like that was not a $60 game because there was not a campaign, it was only
Right.
online. With Destiny, some people say that's not a $60 game because it's only online and they don't have kind of story content. Kind of same story there. I think the way things are going, I could see it where there's just different models for kind of what you get up front. And this is why I feel like games are kind of going always online. And I know this is unfortunate for people who live in areas where they don't
Right.
have great internet. But the way I see it going is that you kind of get certain things. Maybe it's at a $20 price point or a $10 price point, or maybe even $60. But you have to pay something up front basically for kind of that what they're going to build upon over time. Over time, they're going to give you more characters and more stages and certain perks and stuff like that. Different guns, different outfits, stuff like that. But I feel like, the whoever's developing the game needs to make sure that they get a certain amount of money up front from people who are going to pay it, play it, right? Because they
Yeah.
spent all that
I
time.
mean, my ideal situation would be a $60 base game, a significant amount of time, maybe 3 to 6 months to enjoy that base game, and then you release an expansion pack or some significant DLC content, and I'll happily pay, you know, 15 or 20 for that, and then, you know, move on to your next game. Don't release a sequel within a year or two. You know, give us time to... It's like with Battlefield 4. I recently got back into that, and it launched over a year ago, and now, you know, Battlefield... Hardline is going to be out really soon, and then after that it's going to be Star Wars Battlefront, which I have been waiting years and years for, and so have many other people. But it's like you don't have this breather to just enjoy the game and kind of play to its fullest, and you know, get all the DLC that they kind of rush out and all that. And you know, when that happens, games launch with problems, and Battlefield 4 was one of those games. But at the same time, then, if you're just trying to enjoy that base title and the minimal amount of DLC that you want, then they're not making money. So, you know, it's kind of, again, trying to find that perfect balance. So you have to look at it from both sides.
Yeah, I just wonder, like I said, going back to that original kind of theory, is that maybe they would offer something where, you know, with Assassin's Creed, it's $30 for like a whole new, you know, situation, whole new city or whatever, and then they kind of tack on different parts of the city for it or something like that. Or I think of a Grand Theft Auto, maybe you pay $60 up front for, you know, LA, $60 up front for New York, $60 up front from, you know, for Miami, and then they give you kind of free DLC. Like, it could all be different kind of models. Like I said, with the sports games, maybe it's, you know, $50-$60 up front, and then to update the roster each year is enough, another price point. I wonder if that $60 amount is going to go away, because like I said, it's not $60 anymore, in the sense that there's inflation and that the rising cost of
the
next gen games and stuff like that. So maybe 10 years from now, $60 will not be significant in the minds of a gamer, of someone who's, you know, going to
go
purchase
and maybe
game.
They take a small leap, 65, then hit the 70, and, you know, ease us in. But, you know, and it goes back to what we spoke about on an earlier podcast again, about price points and what sells and what doesn't. And a lot of this extra revenue is brought in by these microtransactions for cosmetics and things like that. I'm fine with that, because it doesn't affect your gameplay. You feel, you know, missing out on a costume, for the most part, you're not going to...
It also doesn't affect the players you're playing against, right? People be oh, that looks cool.
You're not, it's not pay to win or anything like that,
Well, or like Destiny, where now if people have the DLC, I can't play with them, right? I didn't go buy the next DLC for it or whatever, like that.
Right. And, I mean, both, you know, the discussion about what you're paying as well as the DLC and the ideal situation, it all kind of plays into this week's big release, which is Evolve. Are you familiar with it at all? Did you play the beta or any other past games?
I didn't play the beta. I've read previews about it.
Okay.
I haven't physically played the game.
Okay, so a good base to kind of compare it to is Left 4 Dead and Left 4 Dead 2. It's basically a 4-versus-1 multiplayer game. So what Left 4 Dead was, is it was 4 survivors in a zombie-infested world, and there could be an opponent on the zombie team trying to actively kill the human players. And basically you had to get from point A to B and clear out different levels and make it to that final boss fight and survive. So what Evolve did, and it evolves on the concept basically, it is a monster hunter game where you have 4 hunters, which are human, and there's a vast number of these hunters. And then you have 1 monster player, and each team, the balancing in this game is fantastic. You know, it sounds like from the main match modes and everything online that the wins and loss ratio for each side are pretty even. So at least like the monsters aren't overpowered, or 4 people trying to beat up 1 other person. You know, it's all balanced. So anyways, the premise of the game is that the 4 hunters have to figure out where the monster is in the map, and there's all these different methods to track it down based on who you're playing as. And it's kind of like, you know, some MMOs where you have a tank player and a healer and a ranged attack and stuff like that. Well, the monster has 3 stages of evolution, and the more objectives it meets or the more enemies that it eats and things like that, it levels up its armor and eventually evolves. And it's kind of like Pokemon, you know, there's 3 levels and the third one is the best. So maybe they ripped that a little bit from Nintendo.
But a very novel concept, right?
Yeah,
not only the 5-player multiplayer, but
you know,
4-versus-1.
The graphics are fantastic. The controls are tight. It's executed well. It kind of reminds me, Because I played the beta and I just can't buy on to the game for reasons we'll discuss in a minute here. But I mentioned before that Destiny was a great game, the mechanics and everything, but it just felt
The
empty.
fundamentals were
Right.
good. Yeah, the
There's a
storyline
good
and
game
stuff.
somewhere in there. The storyline was, there wasn't one. And the game itself, just the content, it's so repetitive. Well, that's kind of what Evolve feels like. And it's also similar to Titanfall, where people didn't feel like they should have to pay $60 for Titanfall, like you said, because it's a multiplayer-only game. There's no single player. So the deal with this then is that it becomes a grind fest. To unlock all these characters, you have to keep playing and playing and using specific abilities, and you're not able to cater to your play style. You have to do it how they tell you to in order to meet these objectives to open this extra content. Well, even then, there's only so many monsters and so many humans available, different hunters. I forget the numbers, but basically, they have all this locked DLC behind a paywall, or excuse me, paywall. And I believe the count right now is at $60 day one DLC. So if you want everything in the game, you not only have to grind your butt off for all of it to unlock it all, you have to pay $120 for the base game and then for all this extra content. And at the end of the day, for something that is super repetitive, and playing the beta, it just didn't pull me in, and I can't see paying that. A better model, in my opinion, would have been a free-to-play model or a very bare minimum price, an arcade price, $15, $20, and then you can unlock the extra content for minimal prices as you play the game and enjoy it.
So I guess my question with this, looking at this as a whole, with Titanfall, with Destiny, with Evolve, are we going to be happy that, we just talked about our favorite games from the last gen, and I think
Right.
disproportionately, now granted, my list was a little weird that, Deus Ex, I think, or Deus Ex, I mean, was one of the original kind of, 2007, I think it came out, and
Yeah, one of the earlier
2005, yeah,
ones.
one of the early games, but in general, your BioShock Infinites, stuff like that came out later, Red Dead, stuff like that. My question is kind of when we're talking about the end of this generation, are we going to be happy that even though Titanfall came out with some flaws, maybe was overexpensive, Evolve maybe came out with some flaws, maybe too expensive.
Right.
Destiny, we didn't like kind of how the DLC, was split between PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Are we going to be happy that those games came out kind of around the time of the launch because it maybe kind of propelled games into the next generation in terms of how online is played? Maybe payments will improve. And just kind of new ideas, I mean the fact that you're dropping Titans from the sky and that you with Evolve you 4 versus 1 and with Destiny, just kind of their loot system and their incentive system within the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a two-sided issue because you're going to be glad that, yeah, they came up with these cool novel concepts and they built upon them and it evolved into what it is, in the future, whatever it is at that time. And I'm sure it'll be great. And there's already talk, Titanfall 2 is in development and on the way. It's going to be for Xbox and PlayStation this time, so it's just not an exclusive anymore. I think that the other side of that though is that you're like, well, why did they not fulfill some of these concepts on these relatively empty games the first time? Why wasn't there more beta testing? Why was there not more insight into the development process and what all they could have done, what they, cut? Why didn't they listen more to what the public actually wanted? And, there's all this overhype, especially with Titanfall. I mean, it was super active and talked about when it first came out. I'll still hop on occasionally, but it's not the big train that they had, hyped it up to be basically. And this especially shows in the reception. Going back to Evolve, the critic reviews, they're giving it great scores, nines, 8.5s, eights, and they're all mentioning though that like, would I actually buy this if I didn't have a review copy? A lot of them are like, no, it is a grind. The enjoyment in Evolve is going to be based on your ability to grind and reach that end goal. And even when you reach it, it's the same thing over and over again. And the user reviews in on things like Metacritic and whatnot are much more reflective of the consumer's issue with DLC and pricing because it's coming in at in the 50s and 60s.
So I think just to wrap up this podcast as a whole, I think it's interesting to look at how games are funded, how people pay for the games, and then ultimately kind of how you create innovation in video games where there should be kind of multiple different genres, there should be multiple different versions of each genre, and really should cater kind of because people spend so much time on it. time on them, excuse me, they should, you know, cater to very specific kind of crowds. I mean, what's your kind of final takeaway from that? I mean, do you really believe that we see the most progress within kind of this generation just because it seems like there's a lot is changing at once?
Yeah, I think we're just kind of in that test phase, like I mentioned, where we're going to have a lot of stuff thrown at us. We're going to see a bunch of the old ways, you know, the $60 with a lot of DLC. We're going to see the new concept like evolve, where they're going to tell you, hey, we have this great new pricing structure. We think it's fair. I think it's the future, is basically what the developers and publishers are telling us. And, you know, with new things, there's always initial backlash. So there's going to be a lot of that. And then whatever ends up thriving becomes the new norm. So we'll see all these new concepts and ideas and see what sticks.
Any final thoughts?
I think that's it for me.
Well, this has been one of the Tickets video game podcast from Old Omaha. Thanks for listening.